It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both?
Good.
Pretty good.
I have this sense of deja vu because we did this last night.
Not a radio show.
Yeah. No, we were on cable access last night with Marlon from Asteroid Cafe.
Social Justice TV.
All right. Did he have some food from the Asteroid Cafe for you?
No, he didn't. It was a letdown.
Well,
that's very good food.
It was like 9 o'clock at night. I mean, I'd already had dinner, so.
All right.
But it was a good show.
Very good. All right. Well, let's hopefully we won't be doing too much deja vu for people that saw that. In terms of coverage, what we're going to talk about, let's start out with some local stuff. Oh, and we should put in too that if we have time, we'll try and get to some email questions. I have one left over from last week, and you can send those to us here at the studio at dj@kexp.org. dj@kexp.org.
And try to keep them short.
Keep it short, or it's not going to make it through. All right, monorail update.
Yeah, well, there were some interesting things happening in the monorail this past week. For one thing, Cindy Laws, the monorail board executive, who's running for re-election at this very moment, really put her foot in her mouth in an endorsement interview with the who was it with? It was one of the unions. I can't remember which one. But she put her foot in her mouth pretty good, talking about the Jews and in the downtown developers who were opposing the monorail.
As if they were one in the same.
As if they were one in the same. And then when a couple of the Jewish members of the editorial board questioned her further on this, said, well, Joel Horn used to joke about the Jews all the time.
Of course, Joel himself is Jewish. And
yes.
She didn't quite grasp the difference between a member of a community joking about their own heritage versus someone from outside the community very serious, taking that seriously and thinking that really is the way reality is.
Yeah, it was pretty appalling for an elected official. And so she has since apologized to the editorial board members. I don't think she's made a public apology for it yet, however.
Nor has she explained why an elected member of the monorail board should emulate the guy they're supposed to be watching over and exercising some kind of oversight.
Well, and not only emulate, but the guy's disgraced right now. He resigned in disgrace because he's driven the monorail into the tank.
yeah. So why would she think that he has any special, you know, insight into why the monorail's not succeeding? I'm not sure.
Well, it was a glimpse into the dysfunctionality of the monorail board because it hasn't been exercising oversight, and that's one of the major reasons they got the problems that they have. But the other interesting thing that happened this week was that the monorail board named a successor to Joel Horn. This guy is named John Haley Jr., and he comes from a consulting firm in San Francisco. Then he has ties in his history with the New York, New Jersey Public Port Authority and Massachusetts Bay Authority and various other East Coast transit agencies. And he is getting well compensated for his history of fine resume padding titles. He is being compensated to the tune of $240 an hour, which, for what we could presume, the title of interim executive director is a full-time, although possibly temporary, gig. It works out to $9,600 a week. Which is a nice job if you can get it. That pencils out to about $500,000 a year. So this for an agency that is in trouble specifically because its budget when it came out and its financing were way reckless in terms of playing with taxpayer money to the tune of, you know, $11 to $14 billion for a transit project that shouldn't be being built for anywhere near that. It seems like they haven't learned very much. Seems like they're just sort of trying to get into the trough while they still can before the whole thing gets shut down. And it really is an argument for making a clean sweep of the monorail board. Unfortunately, most of that board is not elected members. Most of that board is is appointed, but the members that are elected, you know, I think the ones that are elected this time, are the incumbents should be booted out because they have not done their job, and they're continuing to not do their job.
All right. And briefly, there was some coverage this week of the seawall that they're putting in down there by Alaskan Way, that they might be coming up short on it.
Yeah, this of course is for the project of replacing the Alaskan Way viaduct, and they want to build a tunnel, and but as part of that they've got to build a new seawall because the old one built in the 1930s is being eaten away at by sea critters and is generally not in very good shape. Well, University of Washington study came out this week that said that the projections that are being made in terms of how big they're going to build that seawall are not adequate to cope with the global climate change of the 21st century, that they had been projecting that the seawall was going to have to be built 0.9 feet larger, whatever that pencils out to.
Not quite a foot. At least a foot.
But
if
what
you
they
really
were
want to be.
But what they were talking about at the University of Washington study was anywhere from a foot to 2.8 feet as going to be necessary for global climate change warning. And, of course, that is accelerating because every year it seems like we get estimates revised upward of both the speed with which the sea levels are going to be raising, the polar ice caps are going to be melting, and all the other factors that are going to be going into the raising the sea levels, and the temperatures raising and so forth. Every year, those estimates seem to be climbing a little bit, and in terms of both of how fast it's going to happen and how high it's going to go. So you would want to err, one would think, on the side of caution on that one. But so far, what is the agency that's doing that anyway? Who's oversighting that? Mostly, we keep hearing about how Greg Nichols is pushing this through, but I guess it's the State Department of Transportation that has the oversight on that one. But so far, they haven't been taking global climate change into account as much as they should have been.
All right. Well, and quickly as well, sticking with local stuff, Olympia, you're saying, has is proposing a nuclear-free zone?
Yeah, some activists down in Olympia have got through the city council, and it's close to passing at this point. A very good, this is definitely a good news item, a nuclear-free zone initiative, which would not only make Olympia a nuclear-free zone, but would also require the city to divest itself of doing business with companies that have interest in nuclear America, which, you know, basically includes most of corporate America when you get right down to it. You know, GE, General Motors, all of those companies have vast interests in the nuclear industry. And so that's something that's happening down in Olympia, and it's very much something that that other communities, including Seattle, could take a lesson from in terms of what kind of initiatives we could push our city council into doing.
Yeah, because, you know, the energy bill that was passed by Congress this summer just contains a lot of money to boost the nuclear power industry. Everything from helping them with liability, helping the industry with liability issues, to speeding up the permitting process, to insuring these companies. It's just incredible the amount of money that's being thrown at the nuclear power industry to try to get the first power plant built since, I think the last one was built about 30 years ago.
Yeah, 1970s.
Yeah. And there's
76,
been,
I believe.
Yeah, in the studies of how cost-effective it might be and et cetera, et cetera, no one has mentioned anything at all about the waste issues and the safety, and the safety, overall safety issues of operating a nuclear power plant.
And public opinion is generally against the nuclear industry, but, you know, we're getting to the point in terms of our received history where people don't remember the safety issues that caused the nuclear industry to have to shut down in the 1970s. People don't remember Three Mile Island. They don't remember Chernobyl. They don't remember the risks that we're playing with here.
And the lack of oversight.
And the lack of oversight.
And believe me, there's going to be less oversight now than there was then.
Yeah, because what you have basically is nuclear industry figures being the regulators under the Bush administration.
Yeah, a little bit like food safety. You know, the slaughterhouses get to regulate their own, you know, safety for things like E. coli and mad cow disease.
We heard about that this week with mad cow.
That's right. Public Citizen got hold of some documents. They had issued an FOIA request for documents on USDA inspections of slaughterhouses in the last 2 years since the mad cow safety rules were put into place. Rules that include things like not allowing the brain tissues, eyeballs, glands from slaughtered cattle into the human food supply. What they found, what Public Citizen found when they looked through all the documents of the inspections that were done, and get this, the inspections were something on the rate of about 8 million inspections over the last 2 years, but the number of cattle that have been slaughtered far, far outpaces the number of inspections that have been done. Now, when Public Citizen looked at the documents, they found that over 1,000 violations had occurred. When they eliminated violations that were merely part of a company not getting their paperwork done correctly, that had no relationship to the actual slaughtering process, they came up with something on the order of 800 or more violations still that had occurred in the last 2 years, just in the few instances where inspections had been done. And here in the Pacific Northwest, they found, in Washington and Oregon, they found about 8 different violations. Many of these violations are very, very serious, including allowing prescribed tissues into the human food supply.
It's so, proscribed, not prescribed.
Yeah. That is something you ought to keep in mind whenever you take a bite of your hamburger. You know, that's the same kind of thing that the Bush administration is talking about with the nuclear power industry, backing off on regulation and letting the nuclear industry kind of police itself. Well, we know that when an industry operates for profit, the first thing that goes out the window are the safety issues that slow down production and that get in the way of the bottom line.
Yeah, cut into costs.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have that. Get rid of that.
Yeah.
All right. Moving along.
And then, of course, we fight the lawsuits afterwards.
That's right. That's if you're alive afterwards.
Earlier this week, there were candlelight vigils all across the U.S., several of them in the greater Seattle area in support of Cindy Sheehan. And I understand there was good turnout at many of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like 1,500 totally in the Seattle area. Very good turnout, and very good turnout across the country as well. It was really quite inspiring. And then, of course, Cindy Sheehan has to leave. She has to go back to attend to her mother who had a stroke in California. And the question comes up, what happens now with Cam Casey? With Cindy Sheehan gone, you lose the public theater of Sheehan confronting the president and demanding a meeting between the two of them. A number of people have flocked to Camp Casey in support of Cindy Sheehan over the past 2 weeks, including a number of members of military families. And there is quite a bit of talk of Cindy going back to D.C. along with her supporters with the president at the end of his vacation at the end of August. But the question happens, will this be a fatal loss of momentum? Will this be a case where the press loses interest, where the public loses interest, and the protest fizzles out because of a tragedy in Cindy Sheehan's family?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, this whole confrontation was sparked by a tragedy in Cindy Sheehan's family. I think some of the other folks who are down there in that vigil in Camp Casey also are, you know, folks who have been over to Iraq and come back and know that the war is a farce, and a very, very tragic farce. And other people who are relatives of folks who are deployed or have been deployed in Iraq. It would be great to see one of those folks step forward and say, Cindy can't be here, but I have the same questions. My brother or my daughter or my husband was killed in Iraq or is severely wounded and is getting almost no attention from the VA. I have those same questions, and I want to meet with
somebody who has the same kind of moral authority that Cindy Sheehan has.
And hopefully, once that one somebody steps forward and says, well, if Cindy can do it, I can do it, we'll have another person and another person and another person. That's how movements start and are built. You know, and hopefully this won't just die now that Cindy had to go home and take care of her mother.
All right. Well, I guess then tangentially we will move over to this week in Iraq.
Yeah, the big news this week in Iraq is that the Iraqi parliament failed to meet its August 15th deadline to approve a draft constitution. Now, under the terms of the interim constitution, the parliament was supposed to dissolve if it couldn't get a draft constitution approved by August 15th, and then new elections were supposed to be held to elect a new parliament and start the process all over again. But of course, the Bush administration would not let that happen. At the 11th hour, literally near midnight on August 15th. Near midnight on August 15th, the parliament voted to amend the interim constitution so that they wouldn't have to dissolve. And of course, nobody's asking, is that legal? You know, was the parliament allowed to amend its interim constitution to do that?
This is sort of like George Bush at the end of his second term, having his allies in Congress amend the constitution by legislation so that he can have a third term.
Yeah, that's
pretty very similar.
Pretty similar. And then after they took that vote that allowed them to stay in power, regardless of whether or not a draft constitution had been approved, they voted to give the Constitution Drafting Committee another week to get its act together and to get a draft before them so that they could vote on it again. Well, vote on it the first time this next Monday. Of course, by yesterday, when I was looking desperately for any kind of information on how far the Constitution drafting process had gotten, it appeared that they had gotten no further than they had the week before. So, as of Friday, they still had not agreed on most of their key points, including the role of federalism, how much power the central government will have versus the regional governments, the role of Islam in government and the legal system, women's rights, you know, how much autonomy the Kurdish Northern Enclave will have. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week, new issues came up. Not only had they not agreed on any of the old issues, these new issues arose. The Shiites demanded their own autonomous region in the south of the country, which was set forward by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which now has the majority in the Shiite dominated parties in parliament. It's pretty much dominated by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. But the two smaller parties, the Dawa Party and the group that's led by Muqtada al-Sadr, they're both against that notion. They want a united Iraq, but it's the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, who has very close ties to Iran, who wants very much and is pushing very hard for an autonomous region for the Shiites in the south of Iraq. And we talked about this a little bit last week.
And an autonomous region in which Sharia would be enforced, mm-hmm. in which you would have Islamic law, and in which the rights of women would be very much curtailed.
Yeah, and of course, which would make it a little bit easier for them to secede from Iraq and maybe hook up with Iran, also a fundamentalist Shiite state. Now, also new issues on the distribution of oil revenues. They thought they had come to an agreement on this last weekend, but that agreement went completely out of the window over questions of, you know, how much money should the central government get from oil revenues versus the provinces. The Kurds want 60% of the revenues from oil in and around the Kirkuk region. That would leave the central government with very little revenue. Now, another issue came up. The Kurds said, well, not only do we want an autonomous region, we want to vote on independence within a few years after the new constitution goes into effect. And that set everybody off into a tailspin. Also, a proposal for a provision that would give independent legal and political standing to a group of senior Shiite clerics, a council of Ayatollahs, which is called the Majariya. Now, the group Skiri presented that proposal too, which would basically be a step towards a fundamentalist Muslim state. So, with all these new issues on top of the old ones, I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to come to any kind of agreement over a draft constitution for parliament to vote on, one that's going to be acceptable and that's going to pass a nationwide referendum. So the question is this week, what's going to happen on Monday? Is the parliament going to vote to dissolve itself like it should when it hasn't done its job? Or are they going to just vote another extension and another extension and another extension and make this a real farce? We'll see. In the meantime, the Sunni population is preparing for new elections, they are actually counting on the fact that there's not going to be a draft constitution and that parliament's going to have to dissolve itself and there's going to be new elections. So the Sunnis are starting to register people to vote in cities that had almost no turnout in the last elections, places like Bakuba, Tikrit, Ramadi, Fallujah. Those places are all seeing the Sunni population lining up to register to vote. Now, even the Association of Muslim Scholars has gotten involved, and they are the political, well, actually the religious group that is most considered to be most closely tied to the guerrillas. So far, 80,000 people have registered to vote, many of them in the Sunni regions. Now, I just want to talk very briefly about U.S. troop drawdown in 2006. We talked about that last couple of weeks. It's become pretty clear that the U.S. is not going to do a full withdrawal. Now, the Pentagon has been talking about drawing the troops down to about 50 to 60,000 by, you know, the end of summer next year. Well, that's not a full troop withdrawal. And we know that it's not going to be and can't be a full troop withdrawal because the U.S. is building permanent bases in Iraq.
14 of them.
Mm-hmm. And because they're not supplying any equipment at all to the Iraqi military that would allow them to operate as a full military to protect the country from its neighbors, like Turkey, who would love to come in and take the northern Kurdish provinces, or Iran, who would like to annex the Shiite south, etc. So without the U.S. military trying to get a hold of tanks and airplanes, etc., for the new Iraqi military and training anyone in their use, it's become pretty obvious it's going to be like a South Korea situation where the U.S. military stays for decades at a level of at minimum 50 to 60,000 troops.
And as long as the United States military stays, the insurgency continues.
Yep, that's right. And the less likely there's going to be stability in that country.
All right. Well, still have a few things to hit and a little bit of time, so let's try and go through these quickly. The withdrawal of settlers from the Gaza Strip, what hasn't been covered by the corporate media on that?
Palestine.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of the coverage of the withdrawal of some 9,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip and some three or four very small settlements in the West Bank. And it's really taken the focus off what the Israeli government is doing overall, the big picture of what they're doing in the occupied territories. You know, while the cameras are focused on settlers resisting Israeli troops, removing them from their settlements, we're not seeing how the Israeli government, against all international conventions, against international law, is expanding the settlements in the West Bank at the same time that they're closing down the settlements in the Gaza Strip. We're not seeing any discussion at all of the construction of the wall through the West Bank and around Jerusalem, a wall that cuts off whole Palestinian neighborhoods from the schools where their children go to school, from stores where they need to buy food and other items, from their places of worship, from their farms, from their livelihoods. We're not seeing this major human rights violation being covered because all of the focus right now is on the removal of a few settlements from the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, the Sharon government is saying, oh, any kind of discussion of the real removal of those settlements in the West Bank is years, if not decades, down the road. So the Israeli government is seeing this as some kind of international appeasal, this whole step, and that it means that Palestinian nationhood is further off than it was before.
All right. And in Ecuador, things are happening.
Yeah. There was major strikes going on and protests in Ecuador. And you know what happened? The Ecuadorian government said, well, I'm sorry, folks, we have to stop all of our oil exports. We can't actually export any more oil anymore because, my God, those strikers took control of some three dozen different government oil facilities, and now the Ecuadorian government can't even produce oil to export. Why are the strikers and protesters in Ecuador doing this? Well, for a couple of reasons. Mainly, they want a decent wage. And secondly, they want some of that oil revenue that's going into the pockets of rich multinational corporations who have contracted with the Ecuadorian government and into the pockets of Ecuadorian politicians. They want some of that money to come back to their community to build things like, oh, I don't know, schools, hospitals, provide some health care, you know, some decent roads, maybe a nice place to live. They want the same things that everybody else wants. And instead of sitting around and complaining, they got up and they did something. They went on strike and they took control of their country's oil facilities. So now that's about 200,000 barrels per day that's not going on the market, but about half of that goes into U.S. gas tanks. So we're going to see a little pinch at the gas lines because of that.
Okay, and quickly, there's some good news, peace deal in Indonesia.
Yeah, the Indonesian government, this is a little bit of good news, the Indonesian government signed a peace deal with the Aceh rebels, and this peace deal is pretty good because it includes an amnesty for political prisoners, a human rights court to be set up, and a truth and reconciliation commission. But most importantly, Aceh will get 70% of the revenue from its natural resources, including oil, that's been discovered in that part of Indonesia. So that's
and that's important because Aceh is one of the poorest provinces in Indonesia.
Yeah, so that's a good deal for Aceh. On the other hand, Indonesia will keep the largest troop contingent in that province of all the provinces in its nation. There's going to be about 14,700 Indonesian troops based in Aceh. So that Human Rights Commission is going to be pretty busy keeping an eye on them. So we'll cross our fingers and hope that peace deal sticks.
All right, and very quickly, finally, you got an email in regarding Jobs' criticism of the monorail. Jobs' critique of John Haley and the monorail board is not accurate. In fact, it is misleading. Mr. Haley's short-term 2 to 3 months contract is commensurate with, in fact, less than what Sound Transit paid for their interim director when that project was in trouble. Some would say that was money well spent to get that project back on track. That's from Gene Darcy.
Well, that's a comment, and obviously I don't agree with it, because it's an awful lot of money.
Alrighty.
Well, and then Sound Transit, I think, was a little bit further along in the process than the monorail is right now. Plus, I think I saw a figure of about $30,000 a month minimum going to this new guy who will be monorail director. Plus, there's an additional contract with the company that he works for to provide more services, and we don't know the total amount that's going to be, because I think it's probably on an as-needed basis. So the monorail's throwing a lot of money at this person, and it's not even clear that the issues themselves are solvable, whereas Sound Transit was a lot further along in the process.
All right, and finally, any events? I know HempFest is happening this weekend.
Yes, HempFest is happening down at South Lake Union this year, right?
Yeah, I think it's Myrtle Edwards, isn't it?
Don't ask me. I don't know. But you
I'm
can
pretty
find
sure it's
out.
Myrtle Edwards.
I
sure.
thought they had moved it this year, but I could be wrong.
I don't think they'd allow it in South Lake Union. that's a lot of smoke.
So try Myrtle Edwards parking if they're not there. Try South Lake Union.
Yeah,
and it goes from 10 to 8. Both days, today and tomorrow. So, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks at bookstores and cafes and other places where you find free periodicals. It's a publication that put out by local volunteers with the kind of information you hear here, local, global, everything in between. You can also find us on the web, current issues and some back issues as well, at www.eatthestate.org.
All right. Well,
and we can always use volunteers, and we can always use donations.
Okay, and you guys just had your monthly meeting, so people can't.
Yes,
they have to wait a month before they can.
They can always visit our website. We have the current issue up there.
All right.
Yeah, and it's also a way to get in contact with us.